Biblical minimalists want to push the evidence away or say, oh no, it's not conclusive. It's a philosophy that says we can't go by the written record, and if we don't have all kinds of archaeological evidence, we will be very skeptical. The only time you start running into weird history is when you get into biblical studies and you start bumping up against the hypercritics and the minimalists. If we were going to be that hypercritical, we would be in no position even to say anything about Alexander the Great.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, I'll be talking with Craig Evans, author of Jesus and His World.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
With me on the line is Dr. Craig Evans, the author of Fabricating Jesus, Ancient Texts for New Testament Studies, the Holman Quick Source Guide to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and most recently, Jesus and His World, the Archaeological Evidence. It's just now out in paperback, and Dr. Evans is also the Paisant Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. Dr. Evans, it's great to have you on the line.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be with you.
Before we dig into Jesus and His World, the Archaeological Evidence, could you share a little bit of your experience with engaging Bart Ehrman? Because a lot of our listeners will be familiar with Bart Ehrman. He's sort of a sensation, but how has that engagement influenced your take on a particular approach to the New Testament?
Well, you know, it actually has impacted me a lot. I realize how trapped a lot of people are in a very narrow, I would say fundamentalist, but when I say that, I'm not trying to insult anyone or anything like that, but a very narrow and very limited understanding of what Scripture is, mm-hmm. what the Gospels are, what biblical history is. And what happens is we take this very limited and narrow view, a very modern view, I might add, and we impose it on these writings from 2,000 years ago and further back. And then we wonder, you know, they don't seem to measure up to our expectations. Ours is the age of a printed book, mass-produced. Ours is an age of video recording, and so we know word for word what somebody said, exact order of events, that kind of thing. And that's not the way stories were written down. They were interpretive. They were supposed to be. That's how Jesus taught his disciples. That's how they taught others. That's how the Gospels were written down. And so you get this modernistic, fundamentalist kind of driven way. And so it creates a bit of a gap between what the Bible really is and what we think it really should be. And Bart Ehrman exploits that, because that's the same fundamentalism in which he grew up. And so he reached a point in his life where he felt that, you know, the Bible didn't measure up to those expectations. He couldn't trust it anymore. And so that's what concerns me, because there could be other Bart Ehrmans in the making, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so my mission is to make that clearer in talking to students. Look, you can trust the Gospels. The Bible manuscripts are excellent. You just need to know what kind of literature, and that's so important in proper biblical interpretation, you just need to know what kind of literature it is, mm-hmm. and quit measuring it by our modern standards right now, standards which no doubt in the future will change. So that's the big task, and I've become very sensitive to it. And this loss of faith, this shock value, this whatever it is, it's so necessary when the Scriptures are understood. Then you can have confidence in them and not be distracted by these other things.
One last question about Bart Ehrman's very popular criticism of the New Testament in particular. What has surprised you, perhaps, as some of the most egregious misunderstandings that he bases his criticism on?
Well, okay, two things. First, the manuscripts. The idea that the biblical manuscripts, you know, because we don't have the originals, And because our earliest manuscripts that are substantial in size and contents date to about the year 200. And so, you know, if we think of the Gospels written in the 60s and 70s, that means a 125, 135-year gap from when the originals were written and our oldest copies. And so Professor Ehrman and a lot of others assume that it was just, well, copy made a copy of a copy of a copy because the originals are long gone. And so by the time we get to the year 200, the manuscripts that we now have and we look at and we base our New Testament upon, it's assumed that, well, all kinds of changes have taken place. But what we've learned is that actually the originals very likely would have lasted a long time. Most books in antiquity were used for 150 years, sometimes 300-400 years. And so the originals were still circulating for years and years, and they were the benchmark. They were the text that people were using. So the idea that there's a 130-year gap between our copies and the originals, that has to be qualified. The second point that concerns me, though, is the idea that the gospel discrepancies among the gospels, you know, exactly how did Jesus say this, or exactly where was he when he said this? And Bart Ehrman will say something like, Matthew says it this way, Luke says it another way. They can't both be true. You know, that becomes, it's very rhetorical. Well, actually, they both can be true. And that's exactly how Jesus taught. He would say things over and over again. He didn't always say everything the same way. He didn't say something only in this one place. He said it in a bunch of places. And he gave his disciples the freedom. Indeed, he expected them to take his teaching and apply it in creative ways. Yeah, he actually says that in Matthew chapter 13 about the scribe who's been discipled, trained for the kingdom of heaven, knows how to pop open the treasure box and pull out new meanings. Mm. And so we need to get past that hang-up that the Gospels ought to be as though they're a video recording, because they're not. And the interpretive element, the adaptability, that is actually good. That shows that you do understand Jesus's teaching, that you're more than just a tape recorder that repeats it word for word. You actually understand it, and you can make it fit in the appropriate way, in the appropriate setting. That's how Jesus trained his disciples. When we understand that, these problems just aren't problems anymore.
So should we think of the New Testament more as the transcripts of various witnesses in a courtroom trial rather than as a modern biography?
Well, but I would say, you know, they're not even transcripts in that sense, because, the transcripts of witnesses in a modern trial, I mean, that's still a very modern idea. And so what the Gospels are reminiscences, recollections of the witnesses, what they've seen, what they've heard. It has to be interpreted. I mean, look at the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount takes just minutes to read. Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. Do you really think that the people gathered at Jesus' feet and he delivered them a 9-minute sermon and then quit? See, that's my point. I mean, what you have in that sermon is a crafted sermon. Jesus preached many, many sermons on many hills in Galilee. And the Sermon on the Mount, as we call it, is a very skillfully composed discourse by the evangelist Matthew. It's Jesus's teaching, but it's not a tape recording of a particular sermon on one particular day, because that is so unrealistic it wouldn't make sense.
Hence they're called evangelists.
Of course, they're proclaiming the good news of Jesus, and in proclaiming, they're compiling, they're editing. They can't include everything. They're not going to have Jesus repeating himself over and over again. So usually they have just the one saying. Maybe they have it twice. And so there's a selectivity. There's creativity. There's an attempt to adapt. Matthew, I think, has very much in mind the synagogue. He wants to show his Jewish readers that Jesus really did fulfill Scripture. He did not break the law. He really is Israel's Messiah. But that's not Luke's concern. Luke wants to show that Jesus' teaching is relevant for Gentiles. It's relevant for people outside the synagogue. Mark is writing to show people in Italy and in Rome that Caesar isn't the Son of God. Give up on that idea. The real Son of God is Jesus. He's the one that has defeated death. He's the one that can heal and save, not the Roman emperor. So each gospel writer has a particular reason for writing, and they shape their narratives, and they edit and select Jesus' teaching and stories about him with those purposes in mind. And so we naturally then you're going to have differences when you compare them. But that's not something to cause a problem. That's something to actually appreciate and to celebrate, because it gives us different facets, complementary facets of Jesus' teaching, his activities, his lifestyle, and we should be grateful that we have four Gospels that give us four different perspectives instead of just one.
And reminds us that it's all grounded in history.
Of course it's grounded in history, but it's grounded not just in raw history, but in insight, in revelation, in an understanding of, aha, this is who this man is. I mean, Josephus tells us about Jesus, tells us about he's had a reputation of being a teacher and a wonder worker, and that the principal men, that is the ruling priests among the Jews, seized him, handed him over to Pilate. That's history. There's not much interpretation there. There's no insight there. Josephus doesn't really understand who Jesus was and is, but he is recounting some raw history. Well, the Gospels do better than that. They don't just say, well, this is what happened and this is what he said. They go on to explain the significance of it. This is how Old Testament scriptures fulfilled. This is how he impressed people. This is how they were led to faith and began to confess him as God's Son and the real Savior and Messiah. So it's a combination of history and then a divine insight into who Jesus really is and how his message transcends just the 3 years of ministry, but continues to impact and change lives decades later, centuries later, right up to our own time.
Diving in now to your book, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, you talk about biblical minimalists in the book. Who are they, and why do you say that they've fallen on hard times?
Well, you know, biblical minimalists are related to a wider circle of historical minimalists. It's a philosophy, really. It's poor history. It's a philosophy that says, you know what, we just don't have enough evidence, and we can't go by the written record. And if we don't have all kinds of archaeological evidence and multiple witnesses and so on, we will be very skeptical. And I think what it does is it just destroys history. We're not even in a position to say anything about the past. And anyway, there are some biblical minimalists. There are some scholars who adopt that very negative view. And their skepticism becomes almost dogmatic, almost religious-like. So they'll say, well, it doesn't matter that King David is described in 1 and 2 Samuel. It doesn't matter that we hear about Solomon in 1 Kings. Those guys probably didn't live.
So you start with the assumption that it isn't true on the grounds that that is unbiased investigation.
Yeah, I know. I think it's really funny that way. You know, my reaction to that is, well, wait a minute, we've got some very old books. They go back hundreds of years B.C. They tell us in great detail, and by the way, warts and all, there is no whitewashing done of David or Solomon. They tell us about these guys, David and Solomon, and it sure looks realistic, you know. And then guess what? We actually find a reference to David carved in stone, written not by Israel propagandists, but by written by the Syrian kingdom in the around the year 800 and some BC, 9th century, 8th century BC, and it actually is found at Tel Dan up near the Lebanon border. And here it refers to the House of David, the actual dynasty. Sure sounds like a real guy to me, you know. And they say, oh, well, no, that probably means something else, or maybe it's a fake. Well, it's been shown it's not a fake. Well, then they say, okay, maybe there was a kingdom, but it was probably real small. Then they excavate at Jerusalem, and we find a complex of administrative buildings and a palace. Well, it doesn't sound like a little tiny fiefdom. It sounds like an honest-to-goodness kingdom that reaches as far north as Lebanon, as far south as Sinai. Well, okay, maybe so, say the minimalists, but who would have been around to write it? Could they even write back then? Oh, my goodness. So at Caiapha, just a few miles from Jerusalem, another Jewish fortress, they find a piece of pottery with several lines of ancient Hebrew on it, and it sounds like the kind of language we read in 1 and 2 Samuel. Looks like they could write. In fact, that's the way they did write back in the days of David and Solomon. And see, the minimalists, every step of the way, they want to push the evidence away or say, oh, no, it's not very important, it's not conclusive. And so it really is a philosophy. It's not a conclusion based on evidence. It's a predisposition. And I think in this case, it's hyper-skeptical and completely unwarranted.
You observe that only 5% of the sites of the biblical world have been excavated, and that if we insisted on archaeological corroboration before trusting our literary sources, very little history, biblical or otherwise, could be written. One of the marvelous things that you do in this book is bring together, some people will take archaeology, some people will take the New Testament texts, and you bring them together and say we need both, but you're not saying we won't trust the texts until we have the archaeological evidence, right?
Of course, that's right. And, you know, that sentence that you read just now, that underscores that point. And I, you know, history is that's my major, that's my background. And the only time you start running into weird history is when you get into biblical studies and you start bumping up against the hypercritics and the minimalists. You wonder, man, nobody else does that in history. If we were going to be that hypercritical, we would be in no position even to say anything about Alexander the Great. We wouldn't be in any position to talk about the history of ancient Greece, never mind any other ancient peoples. Well, we don't do that. We take the evidence that we have. No, we don't blindly assume that there are no mistakes or no questions or whatever, but we take the evidence that we have and we work with it. And if it, and verisimilitude is a word I talk about in the book. It just means, is it real? Does it compare realistically to the way life really was? And so when we find a text that talks about real places, we can go, and there they are, real events in the past that we can corroborate with other sources, and real people, people that we know really existed, then we begin to suspect that, you know what, this source that we're looking at, whether it's a Bible book or something else, probably has got it right. It is a reliable source, and we ought to make use of it.
How would that verisimilitude work with something like the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas?
Oh, well, that's what kills anybody's trust in the Gospel of Thomas. It isn't realistic at all. It doesn't tell us a thing about Jesus in the early first century in Jewish Palestine. It doesn't resemble early first century Palestine at all. As one Larry Hurtado, a friend of mine who teaches at Edinburgh, as he put it one time, if we didn't know better, if all we had was the Gospel of Thomas, would we even know Jesus was Jewish? Mm. And see, that's the point. Where's the verisimilitude in Thomas? There isn't any. Thomas reflects late 2nd century Syrian Christianity, not early 1st century historical Jesus in the land of Israel. And that's why, by the way, archaeologists don't make any use of the Gospel of Thomas. I think that's a very important point to make. Christian archaeologists, Jewish archaeologists, people of no theological or religious affiliation, they make use of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and the book of Acts when they're talking about first century Israel. They don't make use of the Gospel of Thomas or any of the Gnostic Gospels.
You write that some have suggested Galilean Jews were not especially Torah observant, but had embraced a great deal of Greek culture and thought. And as such, you say, Jesus might have been more of a Hellenistic cynic than a Jewish teacher or prophet. But then you argue, archaeology has set the record straight. Can you explain how archaeology helps set the record straight on that particular point?
Yes. See, there was a scholar who some years ago suggested that Jesus really was more of a cynic, more of a Hellenistic cynic, and you know, influenced by that kind of philosophy. And so he argued that Jesus would have come under that influence because of the proximity of the city Sepphoris. Sepphoris is just a few miles away from the village of Nazareth. And because Sepphoris went through a lot of building in the early first century, Joseph the carpenter and his sons would have been involved in the building program at nearby Sepphoris. And there Jesus would have become influenced, no doubt, by cynic philosophers. Blah, blah, blah. So goes the theory. The problem is archaeology has gone on to show that even though Sepphoris has a Greco-Roman look to it, paved street, columns, grand houses, and so on, it doesn't have any of the pagan trappings. It doesn't have anything that would suggest that any Greeks were there, or that anybody who was non-Jewish, non-Torah observant. Then we found the garbage dump, and it was confirmed, because what we found was in the time of Jesus, all of the animal bones were kosher. They were from cows and sheep and goats, but there were no bones from pigs or dogs. And it's later on, it's after Jesus' time, it's after the year 70, when the big war came to an end and the demographics changed, that's when pig bones became very present in the garbage. In fact, about one-third of the animal bones in the garbage dump were those of pigs. And so that's the point that we're making. Where's this pagan, Hellenistic, cynic Sepphoris of Jesus' time? It didn't exist.
Can you point out some of the impact of archaeological study of first century synagogues on our understanding of Jesus' world?
Oh, yes, of course. And that's very important, because you know, you get the impression from the Gospels that Jesus frequented the synagogue. And it says so, as was his custom. He went to the synagogue. He stood up to read. He unrolled the scroll of Isaiah, found the place where it says this, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." He preaches sermons. He's in synagogues. He heals people in synagogues. And then along comes a scholar who says, well, you know, there really weren't any synagogues. This is all an anachronism. They didn't exist till after the temple was destroyed in the year 70. So the Gospels are just plain wrong. The Gospels, when they were written, they introduced the synagogues anachronistically into the story, because the synagogues existed when they were written. Now, by the way, I think that makes the Gospels way too late. I think most of them were written before 70. They weren't written in the 70s and 80s. In any case, is this true? There were no synagogues in Jesus' time? Are the Gospels just plain wrong on that? Well, archaeologists have identified now seven synagogues. They have no doubt at all were prior to the year of 70, that most of those reach back to the time of Jesus or even earlier. There are two other candidates, so we could have nine synagogues in Israel that date to this early time. And we have two inscriptions that refer to synagogues. One of these inscriptions is from North Africa, and it actually has a date on it, and translated into our calendar, the date is December 3rd in the year 55. So why in the world, you know, what's this theory about no synagogues and the Gospels being anachronistic? Archaeological evidence has just blown that theory to pieces.
What about, is it modern hubris, Dr. Evans, to imagine that first century Jews were illiterate?
Well, I think what it is it's modern ignorance of writing in antiquity. See, most of us, you and I, can pick up a pen and can scribble a note on a piece of paper. We could pick up a book and start reading it, and we would say, well, we're literate people. Well, it's not that simple in an antiquity. I think a lot of people could read, but they couldn't necessarily write. They didn't necessarily have training in how to write, because writing was difficult. You had to know how to make a pen, how to make ink, how to acquire expensive paper. And so lots of people, you know, they could read and they could speak, but they didn't necessarily have the skills to write. And if they wanted to write a letter, they'd go to a scribe and say, I need to send a letter. And the scribe then would write it out. And then the person might sign his or her own name at the end of it, pay the scribe, you know, some money, and then the letter would get into the post and off it would go. So it was just a different world that way. Now, what I find impressive, and I had a very open mind on this whole question, you know, there are scholars who have written books saying only 5% of the adults or 10% of the adults could read. And I started looking at the evidence, and when you find thousands and thousands of inscriptions that are very expensive, public inscriptions in stone to be read by the people in the public, well, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to spend big bucks on inscriptions that nobody can read.
Yeah.
And then you find graffiti scratched on walls, and the graffiti is from all walks of life, from really stupid people, vulgar people, smart people, intellectual people, politicians, wealthy people, poor people. I mean, everybody seems to be able to write something on somebody's on the wall of someone's house.
Interesting.
How is this to be explained? We found a cache of letters written on shingles, written on thin pieces of wood in Vindolanda, that's in England, near Hadrian's Wall. 500 letters, and they're written by servants, written by wives, written by soldiers, enlisted men, written by officers, at all levels, all ranks of life. And here are 500 letters sent or received. And you wonder, well, who in the world? And this is in the western edge of the British Empire at the end of the first century A.D. And yet everybody there seems to be able to write and read letters. So when you look at all of this evidence, and every time we find a place where that kind of evidence was able to survive, there was a market that had collapsed in Asia Minor, and it's from the first century. And sure enough, the plaster is still on the walls in this underground market, like a shopping mall. And guess what? Thousands of graffiti is scratched into the walls. This tells me the percentage of literacy that of the people who could read, at least read and scratch out words, that was a pretty high percentage. And this 5%, I think, is way too low. Mm. Now, as it relates to Jesus, here's an observation. Are we to believe that Jesus really couldn't read, and yet look at the way he argues? He argues with his opponents by saying, "Have you not read in the scriptures?" Mm. Or is this not why you're mistaken? You don't know the scriptures? Is it not written, he asks. Now, how in the world could an illiterate Jesus argue with his critics that way? Yeah, if he couldn't read, he'd be wide open. He'd get demolished in debate if he couldn't read. The other point is, are we to believe that an illiterate Jesus launched a movement that produced books, collected books, created libraries, and invented the university? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think Jesus was literate, so were his disciples, and so the idea that there's a wide gap between an illiterate Jesus and a later literate church that writes gospels not based on eyewitnesses, I find that very far-fetched and unconvincing.
So back to your point about verisimilitude, it has a historical resonance with Jesus beginning his ministry by taking up a scroll and reading Isaiah.
Yes, everything about that makes sense. And by the way, the scroll he read from, Isaiah, the passage he read, Isaiah 61, about the Spirit of God upon him, anointing him. I mean, he alludes to that in his ministry elsewhere when he answers John the Baptist, you know, who's in prison. He alludes to that passage. It's alluded to in two or three of his Beatitudes. This, I think, was pretty close to a life verse for Jesus. He knew Isaiah well. The other thing that's suggestive to me, many times that Jesus quotes or paraphrases Isaiah, it resembles the Aramaic version of the book of Isaiah that we now call the Targum. The Aramaic version, well, guess where the Aramaic version of Scripture developed? It developed in the synagogue, the place where Jesus always was hanging around, teaching, preaching, healing people. So you get not just verisimilitude, but you get a coherence, where that is, the parts fit together. They complement and support one another. And that's what I find in the Gospels, true to life, the way things were back then, and coherence, the pieces fit together. You get a coherent picture that makes sense and is very plausible.
Speaking of inscriptions, could you tell us about the Nazareth inscription, or about the time it's usually dated and the circumstances and how it relates to the gospel accounts?
Well, yeah, the Nazareth inscription, as it's usually called, is referring to a piece of stone that turned up at Nazareth. It probably was originally inscribed and erected in public somewhere else, somewhere in Palestine. And it refers, it's Caesar's edict against tampering with tombs, either vandalizing them, stealing things from tombs, or illegally removing bodies and transferring them to other places. And so what's really interesting about it is it just shows you how seriously Rome, not just the Jewish people, but how seriously Rome took burial traditions and the sanctity of the tomb. And so it's an edict of Caesar that orders criminal proceedings against anyone who illegally removes a body from the tomb or tampers with the grave. And you can see how that gives us important background information about Jesus' own burial and the idea that his disciples might want to take his body illegally, remove it from the tomb or something like that. And we realize, boy, they're not too likely, you know, they're not going to want to do that. It not only would violate Jewish law, but even an edict of Caesar himself, not a good idea.
It's an odd edict, unless there was a problem it was trying to solve.
Well, some wonder if the edict, and some date it to the reign of Emperor Claudius, which would have been from 41 to 54. That's when he was the emperor. And so if it was his edict, it could have been in response to ongoing rumors and accusations that the disciples had taken the body of Jesus. And that's a very interesting point, too, although I've also heard some scholars say that it could have been an edict of Augustus, and so it would have been a law firmly in place even before the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus.
Interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of Qumran scrolls 4Q246 and 4Q521 on our understanding of Jewish messianic expectations?
Oh, yeah, those are great scrolls. You know, they're just small fragments. 4Q246, I'll start there. First of all, for our hearers and our audience to understand, the Q stands for Qumran, and the number 4 in front of that Q means cave number 4. So it's cave number 4 at Qumran, document 246. It's one page of, it's like a small, it's almost like a 3x5 card, that size of leather. 9 lines of text on one side, 9 lines opposite, 2 columns of text in Aramaic. And it refers to a son of God, someone who will come that will be called son of God, son of the Most High, who will rule forever, and he will be called great. Those 4 lines match what Gabriel the angel says to Mary in the famous Annunciation passage in Luke chapter 1. Now, what's significant about that is some critics in the past have said that Luke's language was Greco-Roman or reflected the Roman imperial cult of the divine Caesar, that it was not authentic to the Jewish movement or to the Jesus movement, which is Jewish. Well, here we have a text in Aramaic from the first century B.C. from Palestine that speaks of a coming Savior who will be called Son of God, Son of the Most High, who will rule forever, matching the language that we see in Luke's infancy narrative. I think that's very important. And that, so it shows that what we have in Luke is right at home in Aramaic-speaking Jewish Palestine. The other passage you mentioned is 4Q521, so it's Qumran, K4, document 521. It is in Hebrew, and one of the fragments starts speaking about God's Messiah, which heaven and earth will obey, and when he comes, the blind will regain their sight, the lame will be able to walk, the wounded will be healed, The dead will be raised up, and the poor will have good news preached to them. Now, anybody hears that, and they realize, hey, that sounds an awful lot like what Jesus said to John the Baptist when he asked from prison, are you he who is to come, or should we look for somebody else? And what this shows is Jesus' answer to John was unmistakably messianic. Also, even the part about heaven and earth obeying him, I suddenly think of Jesus walking on the water, or the frightened disciples when they're in the boat, Jesus stills the storm. In other words, even the heavens and the earth obey the Messiah. So that's a very important text, and it underscores how messianic Jesus' ministry really was and the way it would have been understood by his disciples.
That sounds, too, like the Jewish text 2 Esdras. Am I thinking of the right text? Where you have a lot of messianic allusions that sound very similar to gospel statements that Jesus takes on his own lips.
Yes, that's right. The 2 Esdras book, the part that is pre-Christian, and you know, because some of it is a later Christian edition, but it would be chapters 3 through 14. And that's, I think, very authentic pre-Christian Jewish material. Scholars call that part of it 4th Ezra, by the way. And this stuff anticipates the coming of a Messiah. Also, in some manuscripts, he's called God's Son. It seems to be related to the Son of Man figure of Daniel. And so that's a very important text, too. And that text, some others, Dead Sea Scrolls and so forth, supply us with very important background information, contextual information relating to Jesus and his world and how his contemporaries would have understood him and would have appreciated the significance of his teaching and his mighty deeds.
Mm. Can you finally tell us a little bit about the Melchizedek Scroll and how in particular it relates to Isaiah 61?
Oh, yeah, of course. The 11Q13, so there you go. It's Cave 11 of Qumran, Document 13, also called the Melchizedek Scroll, has one column of fairly well-preserved material, column 2, and it begins with a quotation of Leviticus 25:13. Now, that's the Jubilee passage. And so it says, you know, in this in the Jubilee, you get to go home to and your debts are forgiven, and then it goes on to see it very eschatologically. It sees a future coming person who fulfills not just that, but Isaiah 61, and this mysterious person is called Melchizedek. He will forgive Israel of their sins. He will set them free from Satan, called Belial in this text. He will liberate them and defeat their enemies. And you realize, wow, so when Jesus quotes Isaiah 61 in his sermon at Nazareth, lots of scholars thought that it might have a Jubilee feel to it, forgiveness of sins. And sure enough, 11Q13, I think, confirms that. You need to know in Aramaic, the word sin and the word debt comes from the same Aramaic word hoba. And you can see that in some of Jesus' teaching about the sinful woman whose sins are forgiven. He tells the parable of two debtors whose debts are forgiven. And so it all begins to make a lot of sense. Mm. And also you can see why the author of the book of Hebrews compares Jesus to Melchizedek. Because Melchizedek was understood as a mysterious divine figure whose work someday in the future would involve forgiveness of sins and liberating God's people from the problem of sin and Satan and his forces. And you can see that, well, that's what's happening in Jesus' ministry. No wonder the author of Hebrews makes that comparison.
Folks, the book we're talking about here, among others, is Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence by Dr. Craig Evans. Professor Evans, thanks a lot for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
Thank you, Mike. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org. www.quedmeonthelinefoundation.org.